Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to New Heights Show on Education. This is your host, Kathy Woodring. Today's show topic is Thomas Paine biography and his influence in America. You can call in to speak to us anytime during this show at 347-633-9225 or contact New Heights at 419-786-0247 or New Heights Education at yahoo.com, or visit our site at www.newheightseducation.org. You can also chat with us live during any of the shows. Please remember to click follow us for updates on upcoming shows, or you can visit our website to see host bios and keep track of your favorite host and our shows. New Heights continues to offer its biweekly enrichment day and or co-op classes. Next class will be on March 28th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Classes will be held in Defiance at the Zion Lutheran Church. Please note that the classes are not religion-based unless families want there to be one. Parents and students are required to participate in these classes and help with the planning of them. We are offering a reading time, Irish dancing, and karate, and are open to more suggestions. Students are invited to not only attend, but to participate in instructing some of the classes. If you are interested in participating, volunteering, or tutoring, please contact us directly. Tutors and or teachers are needed. We are in need of tutors and or teachers in Defiance and Putnam County. Anyone that would like to volunteer should contact us directly. There are also some paid opportunities. We are currently need reading tutors. New Heights is currently in need of a home for our library. We will need to move from our current location by March 25th. If you can help us, please contact us as soon as possible. We are planning a bake sale, candy, and candle sale on Saturday, April 5th at the Northtown Mall. Check our site for more information and updates. A special welcome to our board member, Marianne Hurst, who is now going through a training program here at New Heights. She is learning the ins and outs of our many programs with hands-on experience. We are happy that she has shown such an interest in learning about the daily routines of New Heights. Now to our show topic, Thomas Paine biography and his influence in America. The last show addressed the book Founding Brothers by Joseph J. Ellis. Page 6 continues with mention that though through the Republican paradigm, representative government bottomed on the principle of popular sovereignty, has become the political norm in the 20th century. No Republican government prior to the American Revolution, apart from a few Swiss cantons and Greek city-states, have ever survived for long, and none have ever been tried over a landmass as large as the 13 colonies. There was one exception, but it proved the rule, the short-lived Roman Republic of Cicero, which succumbed to the imperial command of Julius Caesar. And finally, the 13 colonies spread along the eastern seaboard and stretching inward to the Alleghenies and beyond into unexplored forest occupied by hostile Indian tribes had no history of enduring cooperation. The very term American Revolution propagates a wholly fictional sense of national coherence, not present at the moment. and only discernible in latent form by historians engaged in after-the-fact appraisals of how it could possibly have turned out so well. Ellis mentions that hindsight is a tricky tool on pages 6 to 7. Too much of it, and we obscure the all-pervasive sense of contingencies, as well as problematic character of the choices facing the revolutionary generation. We need a historical perspective that frames the issues with one eye on the precarious contingencies felt at the time, while the other eye looks forward to the more expansive consequences perceived dimly, if at all, by those trapped in the moment. We need, in effect, to be nearsighted and farsighted at the same time. On the farsighted side, the key insight, recognized by a few of the political leaders in the revolutionary generation, is that the geographic isolation of the North American continent and the bountiful natural resources contained within it provided the fledgling nation with massive advantages and almost limitless potential. Thomas Paine eventually saw much potential for individual freedom in America. A Wikipedia entry covers the history of Paine's theology with the following description. In December 1792, Paine's Right of Man, Part 2, was declared seditious in Britain, and he was forced to flee to France in order to avoid arrest. Dismayed by the French Revolution's turn towards secularism and atheism, he composed Part 1 of The Age of Reason in 1792 and 1793. It has been my intention for several years past to publish my thoughts upon religion. The circumstance that has now taken place in France of the total abolition of the whole national order of priesthood and of everything appertaining to compulsive systems of religion and compulsive articles of faith has not only precipitated my intention, but endeared a work of this kind exceedingly necessary. Lest in the general wreck of superstition, of false systems of government, and false theology, we lose sight of morality, of humanity, and of the theology that is true. Although Paine wrote The Age of Reason for the French, he dedicated it to his fellow citizens of the United States of America, alluding to its bond with the American revolutionaries. It is unclear when exactly Paine drafted Part 1, although he says in the preface to Part 2, "Conceiving that I have but a few days of liberty, I sat down and brought the work to a close as speedily as possible, and I had not finished it more than 6 hours, in the state it has since appeared, before a guard came there about 3 a.m. with an order for putting me in arrestation as a foreigner and conveying me to the prison of Luxembourg. I contrived in my way there to call on Joel Barlow, and I put the manuscript of the work into his hands." Meanwhile, Paine, considered too moderate by the powerful Jacobean wing of the French revolutionaries, was imprisoned for 10 months in France. He only escaped the guillotine by accident. The sign marking him out for execution was improperly placed on his cell door. When James Monroe, at the time the new American minister to France, secured Paine's release in 1794, Paine immediately began work on Part 2 of The Age of Reason, despite his poor health. Part 2 was first published in a printed edition by H.D. Simmons in London in October 1795. In 1796, Daniel Isaac Eaton published Parts 1 and 2 and sold them at a cost of 1 shilling and 6 pence. Eaton was later forced to flee to America after being convicted of seditious libel for publishing other radical works. Paine himself financed the shipping of 15,000 copies of his work to America. Later, Francis Place and Thomas Williams collaborated on an edition which sold about 2,000 copies. Williams also produced his own edition, but the British government indicted him and confiscated the pamphlets. In late 1790, Paine fled from France to the United States, where he wrote Part 3 of The Age of Reason, an examination of the passages in the New Testament quoted from the old and called prophecies concerning Jesus Christ. Fearing unpleasant and even violent reprisals, Thomas Jefferson convinced Paine not to publish it in 1802. 5 years later, Paine decided to publish despite the backlash he knew would ensue. Following Thomas Williams' sentence of 1 year hard labor for publishing The Age of Reason in 1797, no editions were sold openly in Britain until 1818, when Richard Carlyle included it in an edition of Paine's complete works. Carlyle charged 1 shilling and 6 pence for the work, and the first run of 1,000 copies sold out in a month. He immediately published a second edition of 3,000 copies. Like Williams, he was prosecuted for seditious libel and blasphemous libel. The prosecutions surrounding the printing of The Age of Reason in Britain continued for 30 years after its initial release and encompassed numerous publishers as well as over 100 booksellers. The Age of Reason is divided into 3 sections. In Part 1, Paine outlines his major arguments and personal creed. In Parts 2 and 3, he analyzes specific portions of the Bible in order to demonstrate that it is not the revealed word of God. This Wikipedia entry continues with an analysis of Paine. At the beginning of Part 1 of The Age of Reason, Paine lays out his personal belief. He states that I believe in one God and no more, and I hope for happiness beyond this life. I believe in the equality of man, and I believe that religious duties consist in doing justice, loving mercy, and endeavoring to make our fellow creatures happy. But least it should be supposed that I believe many other things in addition to these, I shall, in the progress of this work, declare the things I do not believe, and my reasons for not believing in them. I do not believe in the creed professed by the Jewish church, by the Roman church, by the Greek church, by the Turkish church, the Protestant church, nor any church that I know of. My own mind is my own church. All national institutions of churches, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, appear to me no other than human inventions set up to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit. I do not mean by this declaration to condemn those who believe otherwise. They have the same right to their belief as I have to mine, but it is necessary to the happiness of man that he be mentally faithful to himself. Infidelity does not consist in believing or in disbelieving. It consists in professing to believe what he does not believe. Paine's creed encapsulates many of the major themes of the rest of his text: a firm belief in a creator God, a skepticism regarding most supernatural claims, here the afterlife, later in the text, miracles, a conviction that institutions and emphasis, a conviction that virtues should be derived from consideration for others rather than from oneself, an animus against corrupt religious institutions, and an emphasis on the individual's right of conscience. After establishing that he would refrain from using extra-biblical sources to inform his criticism, but would instead apply the Bible's own words against itself, Paine questions the sacredness of the Bible, analyzing it as one would any other book. For example, in his analysis of the Book of Proverbs, he argues that its sayings are inferior in keenness to the proverbs of Spaniards and not more wise and economical than those of American Franklin. Describing the Bible as fabulous mythology, Paine questions whether or not it was revealed to its writers or doubts that the original writers can ever be known. He dismisses the idea that Moses wrote the Pentateuch. My intention is to show that those books are spurious and that Moses is not the author of them, and still further, that they were not written in the time of Moses, nor till 700 years afterward, that they are no other than an attempted history of the life of Moses and of the times in which he is said to have lived, and also of the times prior thereto, written by some very ignorant and stupid pretenders to authorship several hundred years after the death of Moses, as men now write histories of things that happened or are supposed to have happened several hundred or several thousand years ago. Using methods that would not be common in biblical scholarship until the 19th century, Paine tested the Bible for internal consistency and questioned its historical accuracy, concluding that it was not divinely inspired. Paine also argues that the Old Testament must be false because it depicts a tyrannical God. The history of wickedness pervading the Old Testament convinced Paine that it was simply another set of human-authored myths. He deplores people's credulity brought up in habits of superstition, he wrote. People in general know not how much wickedness there is in this pretend word of God, citing Numbers chapter 3, verse 13 through 47, as an example, in which Moses orders the slaughter of thousands of boys and women and sanctions the rape of thousands of girls at God's behest. Paine calls the Bible a book of lies, wickedness, and blasphemy. For what can be greater blasphemy than to ascribe to wickedness of man, to the orders of the Almighty? Paine also attacks religious institutions, including priests, for their lust for power and wealth and the church's opposition to scientific investigation. He presents the history of Christianity as one of corruption and oppression. Paine criticizes the tyrannical actions of the church as he had those of governments in the rights of man and common sense, stating that the Christianity theory is little else than the idolatry of the ancient mythologist, accommodated to the purposes of power and revenue. This kind of attack distinguishes Paine's book from other deistic works, which were less interested in challenging social and political hierarchies. He argues that the church and the state are a single corrupt institution which does not act in the best interest of the people. Both must be radically altered. Paine comments that soon after I published the pamphlet Common Sense in America, I saw the exceeding probability that a revolution in the system of government would be followed by a revolution in the system of religion. The adulterous connection of church and state, wherever it has taken place, has so effectively prohibited by pains and penalties every discussion upon established creeds and upon first principles of religion, that until the system of government should be changed, those subjects could not be brought fairly and openly before the world, but that whenever this should be done, a revolution in the system of religion would follow. Human inventions and priestcraft would be detected, and man would return to the pure, unmixed, and unadulterated belief in one God and no more. As Joe Mee, a scholar of British radicalism, writes, Paine believed a revolution in religion was the natural corollary, even prerequisite, of a fully successful political revolution. Paine lays out the vision of, in Davidson and Sheikh's words, the age of intellectual freedom, when reason would triumph over superstition, when the natural liberties of humanity would supplant priestcraft and kingship, which were both secondary effects of politically managed foolish legends and religious superstitions. In this vision that scholars have called Paine's secular millennialism, and it appears in all of his works, he ends the rights of man, for example, with a statement, from what we now see, nothing of reform in the political world ought to be held improbable. It is an age of revolutions in which everything may be looked for. Cain transformed the millennial Protestant vision of the rule of Christ on earth into a secular image of utopia, emphasizing the possibilities of progress and human perfectibility that could be achieved by humankind without God's aid. Wikipedia continues with Paine's intellectual debt. Although Paine liked to say that he read very little, his writings belie this statement. The Age of Reason has intellectual roots in the traditions of David Hume, Spinoza, and Voltaire, since Hume had already made many of the same moral attacks upon Christianity that Paine popularized in the Age of Reason. Scholars have concluded that Paine probably read Hume's works on religion or had at least heard about them through Joseph Johnson's circle. Paine would have been particularly drawn to Hume's description of religion as a positive source of harm to society that led men to be factious, ambitious, and intolerant. More of an influence on Paine than Hume, however, was Spinoza's Tractatus Theologico Politicus, 1687. Paine would have been exposed to Spinoza's ideas through the works of other 18th century deists, most notably Conyers Middleton. Paine would also more than likely have been familiar with Voltaire's mocking wit and the works of other deistic French philosophers. Though the larger philosophical traditions are clear influences on the Age of Reason, Paine owes the greatest intellectual debt to the English deists of the early 18th century, such as Peter Annett. John Toland had argued for the use of reason in interpreting structure. Matthew Tyndall had argued against revelation. Middleton had described the Bible as mythology and questioned the existence of miracles. Thomas Morgan had disputed the claims of the Old Testament. Thomas Woolston had questioned the believability of miracles, and Thomas Chubb had maintained that Christianity lacked morality. All of these arguments appear in the Age of Reason, albeit less coherently. Next, Paine's rhetoric and style is commented on. The most distinctive feature of the Age of Reason, like all of Paine's works, is its linguistic style. Historian Eric Foner argues that Paine's works forged a new political language designed to bring politics to the people using a clear, simple, and straightforward style. Paine outlined a new vision, a utopian image of an egalitarian republican society, and his language reflected these ideals. He originated such phrases as the rights of man, the age of reason, the age of revolution, and the times that try man's souls. Foner also maintains that with the Age of Reason, Paine gave deism a new, aggressive, explicitly anti-Christian tone. He did this by employing vulgar, that is, low or popular, language in irreverent tone and even religious rhetoric. In a letter to Leo Palmer, one of his most loyal followers in America, Paine describes part of his rhetorical philosophy. The hinting and intimidating manner of writing that was formerly used on subjects of this kind, meaning religion, produced skepticism but not conviction. It is necessary to be bold. Some people can be reasoned into sense, and others must be shocked into it. Say a bold thing that will stagger them, and they will begin to think. Paine's rhetoric and broad appeal, his pithy lines were able to bridge working class and middle class cultures and become common quotations. Part of what makes Paine's style so memorable is his effective use of repetition and rhetorical questions, in addition to the profusion of anecdote, irony, parody, satire, feigned confusion, folk matter, concrete vocabulary, and appeals to common sense. Paine's conversational style draws the reader into the text. His use of we conveys an illusion that he and the readers shall share the activity of constructing an argument. By this emphasizing and presence of the reader and leaving the images and arguments half-formed, Payne encourages his readers to complete them independently. The most distinctive element of Payne's style in The Age of Reason is its vulgarity. In the 18th century, vulgarity was associated with the middling and lower classes and not with obscenity. Thus, when Payne celebrates his vulgar style and critics attacked it, this dispute is over class accessibility, not profanity. For example, Payne describes the fall this way. The Christian mythologists, after having confined Satan in a pit, were obliged to let him out again to bring on the sequel of the fable. He is then introduced into the Garden of Eden in the shape of a snake or serpent, and in that shape he enters into familiar conversation with Eve, who is in no way surprised to hear a snake talk. And the issue of this tete-a-tete is that he persuades her to eat an apple, and the eating of that apple damns all mankind. After giving Satan this triumph over the whole creation, one would have supposed that the church mythologists would have been kind enough to send him back again into the pit, or if they had not done this, that they would have put a mountain upon him, for they say that their faith can remove a mountain, or have put him under the mountain, as the former mythologists have done, to prevent his getting among the women and doing more mischief. But instead of this, they leave him at large, without even obliging him to give him his parole, the secret of which is that they could not do without him. And after being at the trouble of making him, they bribed him to stay. They promised him all the Jews, all the Turks by anticipation, 9/10 of the world beside, and Mohammed into the bargain. After this, who can doubt the bountifulness of the church Christian mythology? Having thus made an insurrection and a battle in heaven, in which none of the combatants could either be killed or wounded, put Satan into the pit, let him out again, gave him a triumph over the whole creation, damned all mankind by eating of an apple, these Christian mythologists bring the two ends of their fable together. They represent this virtuous and amiable man, Jesus Christ, to be at once God and man, and also the Son of God, celestially begotten on purpose to be sacrificed, because they say that Eve, in her longing, had eaten an apple, as described by Payne. The irreverent tone that Payne combined with his vulgar style set the work apart from his predecessors. It took deism out of the hands of aristocracy and intellectuals and brought it to the people. The next episode will cover Payne's early life and final years. Thanks for listening, and please remember to join host Sadia Ijaz Friday at 6 p.m. Saturdays, you can join host Kaden Behan for her show starting at 6 p.m. Sundays, you can join me, Kathy Woodring, for my show at 11 p.m. Thanks for listening, and have a great night.
I am strong. to mourn I can be.